If you look through the five books of Moses, there's not once any explicit mention of the idea of an afterlife. There are hints, there are allusions to it. For example, the Torah talks about death. When it describes the death of a righteous person, the expression the Torah uses is, and Abraham died, and he expired, and he was gathered to his people, and he was buried by his son Yitzchak and Ishmael. So, clearly, gathered to his people doesn't mean buried, because it says buried right afterwards. Gathered to his people does not mean die, because it says died beforehand. So what does it mean when it says gathered to his people? The answer is, it's an allusion to the idea of an existence beyond this world. Other allusions, for instance, one of the other expressions used for the death of a righteous person is shachav im avotav, which means lay down with his ancestors, with his forefathers. Again, explicitly not referring to death or burial, but something beyond that. Now, if you look in the prophets and the writings, the idea of the world to come and the existence after death is explicit. Anyone know the most explicit reference to it in the prophets and writings, in the Torah in general? The explicit reference to the existence of life after death. More explicit than that. Samuel the prophet, there's a story of Saul, the king Saul, who goes to a woman and asks her to conjure up Samuel. And Samuel he sees an image of Samuel, and Samuel communicates to him from death. And Samuel asks him, why did you disturb me? Right? In other words, there's very explicit, there is a concept of the afterlife. But what's very strange about it is that it's not mentioned in the five books of Moses. Now, if you read the texts of any religion, they are replete with mentions of heaven, of hell, of the afterlife. The New Testament talks about it continuously. Kingdom of heaven, gnashing of teeth, etc. The Quran talks in many, many places about the joy of the world to come, the huri, etc., etc., of the world to come. Very, very explicit references to it. Yet, the five books of Moses just doesn't talk about it. And this is the question that bothered many, many of our commentaries. And each one offers a different answer. Some of those answers disagree with each other, but each one of the answers sheds some light on the concept of the world to come. The first answer, which is alluded to by Maimonides, and I spoke about it a little bit in one of the lectures previously, is the idea of altruism. Altruism. Why do we do what we do? Why should we be involved in this? Because we are going to get a reward to avoid punishment? That is good. If you do it for those reasons, that's wonderful. But it's not the ideal. The ideal, ultimately, is to do that which is good because of the value of doing truth and goodness. My wife tells me that if a child creates a beautiful work of art, you should not give the child a reward for that. Here's a candy. No, because that devalues the art in and of itself. There's a value to beauty. The beauty of this art in and of itself. To devalue it by giving him a candy for it is inappropriate. It's wrong. You know, we know that at the early stages of life, a child has to be motivated not by altruism, they have to be motivated by bribery. Right? If I tell a little kid, would you like to learn the aleph base? And I say, maybe, sometimes yes, sometimes no. So I say, if you learn the aleph base, the entire world of Jewish literature, of Torah, will be open to you. The Torah, the prophets, the writings, the written law, the oral law, the midrash, the Zohar, 3-year-old, right? And he'll look up at me, Aria will look up at me and says, can I get a candy? So now as I get a bit older, I say, well, learn this and, you know, and knowledge, history and science. You know, I have a doll. And as they get older, they want a CD-ROM. And as they get older, they want a faster modem, right? And so on and so forth, right? But really, the ideal is to do that, which is, at a certain point in life, a child starts to realize the value of reading without you having to bribe them to read. When they're little kids, they're 3, but by the time they're 9, you can't tear them away from their book. Okay, that's the idea. So now, there's a very beautiful story, which is not very well known, although the character is well known. The Chafetz Chaim, Rabbi Yisrael Meir Kagan, was a rabbi from Radun, from the beginning of last century. He was most famous for his camp. Radun is a place in Russia, Poland, or Austro-Hungary, depending on the year. But in any case, not that the town moved, but the empires moved. In any case, the Rabbi Yisrael Meir Kagan was very, very famous for his campaign for ethical speech. He wrote numerous books about it. He used to give speeches about it. He wrote pamphlets, and he inspired people to start thinking in terms of ethical speech. In Hebrew, the term for prohibited or unethical speech is Lashon Hara, the evil tongue. So anyway, he was well known for that, Chafetz Chaim. So he walks into a hotel lobby, Marriott Warsaw, right? And he walks into this hotel lobby, and there's a group of Jewish businessmen standing around talking to each other, and they are laughing their heads off. So Chafetz Chaim says to himself, wonder what they're talking about. Are they talking words of Torah? Doesn't seem likely that they'd be laughing their heads off at words of Torah. He says, are they discussing business? Highly unlikely. Polish Jewish businessmen last century, right? We had nothing to laugh about when it came to business. And if you'd ask them, and they made $1 million on the Warsaw Stock Exchange that day, they'd probably say, you'd ask them, how's business doing? They'd probably say, no, could be better. So they're probably not talking about business. So what are they talking about? He says, very likely, the type of talk that would elicit the belly laughs that they're going through must be about someone who's not there. They're probably speaking Lashon Hara, process of elimination. He didn't decide definitely that that was so. But he walks over to them, tremendous act of courage, walk over to a group of Jews and tell them they're doing the wrong thing, right? It's almost like a kamikaze rabbi. So he walks over to them, and, you know, little band, Muggin David, you know, and he says, no! You know, so he says to them, he says, excuse me, I beg of you, if you are speaking badly about another person, please don't do it. Change the topic of conversation. Talk about something else. So one of them looks at him and says, who the heck are you? And he says, my name is Israel Kagan. He says, you're the Chafetz Chaim? The rabbi they call the Chafetz Chaim. And Rabbi Kagan says, yep. He says, well, he says, where do you get to be morally superior to me? You're the one with all the books campaigning against Lashon Hara. He says, well, you know what? I don't think you're morally superior to me. I don't think you have any right to tell me what to do. He says, I'll tell you why. Because he says, the reason I speak Lashon Hara is because I enjoy it. It is very, very pleasurable. And I get pleasure from it right here and now. He says, and the reason you campaign against it is because you're going to get pleasure when you die. So the only difference between you and me is you're more patient than I am. You're willing to wait for the pleasure. I'm not willing to wait. He says, get off your moral high horse, right? He says, don't tell me what to do. He says, I do it because I get pleasure now. You do it because you get pleasure after you'll die. The only difference is 100 years. So Rabbi Kagan is speechless, which for a rabbi is just inconceivable. Right? He's speechless, doesn't know what to say. So one of the businessmen says, Rabbi, let's make a deal. He says, I am willing, takes out a piece of paper. He says, I am willing to sign a contract. I am willing to promise that I will never again, or I will attempt never again to speak Lashon Hara. But on condition, you must sign a contract that you give up all reward in the world to come for your activities regarding ethical speech. The books, the pamphlets, the speeches, give it all up. Say to God, I don't want it. And he says, and in return, that'll prove to me you're on the moral high ground. Rabbi Kagan thinks about this and he says, fine, we'll do it. And they start writing it. And the businessman says to the Rabbi Kagan, he says, I know what you're thinking. You're thinking this. Think of the reward I'm going to get in the world to come for giving up my reward in the world to come. He says, so I want you to write that you give up all reward in the world to come, both direct and indirect, as a result of either active or passive engagement in anything to do with the ethical speech. How about that? So Rabbi Kagan says, fine. And they continue writing. And as they get to the end, Rabbi Kagan is crying, but they continue writing. And as he's about to sign it, the businessman puts his hand on the rabbi's hand and he says, Rabbi, okay, you're right. He says, I see that you're willing to do this. He tears it up and he says, I commit myself not to speak Lashon Hara. It's a beautiful story. And I think what it illustrates is that Rabbi Kagan was not in it because he was going to get the pleasure in 100 years. He felt that it was right to tell this person not to speak Lashon Hara. He felt he was doing the right thing. And if it meant that he's not going to get rewarded, that's the way it is. He's in it, not for the reward, but for the good that he is doing. That's the idea. And it was his sincerity that was able to have that impact on the person. There's another amazing story about the Chafetz Chaim, which is just parenthetical. But there was a student in his yeshiva who was found to be smoking on the Sabbath, which is prohibited. Actually, during the week, it's also prohibited. In any case, he was smoking on the Sabbath, and the parents were distraught, religious family, Radun, and they sent him to speak to Rabbi Kagan. He goes into Rabbi Kagan's office. He comes out about 5 minutes later. He's crying, and he tells his parents, never again will I smoke on Shabbos. And the parents were very happy about this. And I heard the story. Rabbi Riskin was telling the story. And he said he really wished he knew what the Chafetz Chaim said. And an elderly man in the audience said, I know what he said. Rabbi Riskin said, how do you know? He says, I was the kid. So he says, what did he say? He says, I'll tell you, I don't know. I walked into the office. He took my hands in his hands. He looked into my eyes. He said, Shabbos. And he started crying. I looked into his eyes and I started crying. We're both sitting there crying, right? And about 3 minutes of this, I said, okay, this is it. But it was the fact that sincerity, that commitment, that altruism was something you could feel coming out of the Chafetz Chaim. When he said to some, it was enough for him to say to someone, Shabbos. And that was it. That was it. I've tried this, it doesn't work. At least not with me anyway. I mean, not because of me, it's the people today just not. Anyway. So that's the first idea. That's Maimonides. Maimonides alludes to this idea and he says, that's really one reason that it's not mentioned in the Torah explicitly. It's as if the silence of the Torah is yelling at us, is shouting at us, and telling us that's not where the focus of life should be. The focus of life, here. That's number one. There are others, the opinion of the Ibn Ezra and the Maharal, which is that the reason it's not mentioned is because really the world to come is a totally spiritual existence. Now, we know that humans speak language. Human language is always based on our experience. We cannot describe things. We have no language to describe things outside of human experience. We can't even imagine things outside of our experience. We can only put components together of things that we've experienced in bizarre ways. I mean, you can dream that you're at a wedding in a nuclear submarine, right? I just read Tom Clancy, the first Tom Clancy book, Hunt for Red October. And at the same day that I finished it, I got a wedding invitation from a good friend. That night, I dreamt I was at his wedding in the missile silo of a nuclear submarine. So we can put components of different things together, right, in our mind, right? But the fact of the matter is we need some type of experience in order to express it in words. For example, a blind person, you cannot describe color to that person. There's no common vocabulary. There's nothing that we can use without reference to color. You take a fish, for example. Imagine your fish wants to go on an expedition to dry land. So you say to him, look, there are certain things I want you to be careful of. You know, he's got his aqualung on filled with water, right? And you're talking to him and you're briefing him before the mission. He says, look, right, be very careful of certain things. Don't go anywhere near a fish and chip store. Sushi bars, stay away, right? Okay, so the fish says, yeah, no worries. And he says, then you tell the fish, right, and also stay away from fire. And the fish says, fire? What's that? He's like, you know, fire. How can a fish know what fire is? Has no idea. So, with what you do, you take the fish, put him in a goldfish bowl. Don't try this at home. Put it in the microwave on low. About a minute and a half. Right, take the fish out and say, like, what do you think? And he says, oh, bad trip. Do you say, like, I'll tell you what. Right, if you start to feel like this on dry land, you should know that you're approaching fire. In other words, you can have experiences that in some way simulate this experience, but you still don't have vocabulary to describe it. That's one of the reasons Shabbos is described in the Talmud as Me'ein Olam Haba, a taste of the world to come. It's type of like microwaving the soul. You know, so to speak, we have an experience in this world which is a little bit of a taste of the same experience of the world to come. Right? Doesn't happen every Shabbos, doesn't happen to every person, but you can get that experience of the combination of physical and spiritual pleasure, right? And of sitting there and the family is singing and you're at the and you can get that experience sometimes. My father says that since one element of the world to come is the resurrection of the dead, it would be logical that you'd also experience that on Shabbos. He says, where do you feel that? He says, very simple. After shul, you have herring for kiddush with some vodka or shulevitz. You come home and have a heavy cholent for lunch, massive lunch. You have some cold soda. You lay down in the afternoon to sleep. If you wake up for afternoon service, you've experienced a taste of the resurrection as well. So, this is the idea of how we work. Now, since we don't have words to describe a completely spiritual experience, the Ibn Ezra and the Maharal say an amazing thing. They said prophecy is limited. Prophecy is limited also by the experience of the prophet. He doesn't have the vocabulary and there are no words that can be used to describe to him something beyond experience. God, we can talk about because God interacts with this world. So the prophets can talk and do talk about him. But the world to come, it says, Ayin lo ra'ata Elokim zulatecha ya'aseh l'machakim lach. No eye has seen it, God, aside from you, that which is expecting and is waiting for those whose hopes are within you. So that is the basic problem. I mean, an example of this, you see this very often with children. We always try to fit things into the categories of our experience. Maybe we don't want Olam Haba, the world to come, to be squeezed into a category of physical experience. Maybe it's better to leave it out of the box. Maybe it's better to leave it unsaid and alluded to so that we don't come up with gross physical descriptions, right, a la Dante's Inferno, right, a la Paradise Lost, etc., etc. It's better to leave it unsaid rather than squeezing it into those boxes. I remember when we went to Toronto in 92, I bought a swing set. I was coming home from the store, and I have a large flat cardboard box on the roof rack of my car with the swing set in it. And my son, Shmuley, who at the time I think was 3 years old, large flat cardboard box. I'm like taking this off the car. Take it off the car. And he's looking up and he says, Abba, big pizza. And you see, things that come in flat square cardboard boxes are pizzas. So this happens to be one that fits the roof rack of the car. It's a big pizza. Also, those who are familiar with my eating habits will understand his, he wasn't shocked at all. But So that's the Ibn Ezra and the Maharal. Of course, I'm taking liberties with the Aramaic, but that's what the Ibn Ezra and the Maharal basically say about the exclusion of Olam Haba from the five books of Moses. There's a third answer, which is the answer of the Rabbi Yehuda Halevi, the Kuzari, also of Nisingon, which is the following. They say that, you see, a prediction about the world to come is an easy prediction to make. There's a British scientist, philosopher and scientist by the name of Sir Karl Popper. Anyone heard of Sir Karl Popper? So Sir Karl Popper has a theory which he says the following. Any theory that cannot be falsified is not a significant or meaningful statement. It's not really a scientific statement. If I cannot falsify it, I cannot verify it. Now, there are those who dispute Sir Karl Popper, but the basic gist of what he's saying is, if I make a statement that no one can really prove or disprove, it's easy to do it. It doesn't mean a darn thing. It's not scientifically significant. So the Rabbi Yehuda Halevi says the following. He says, any religion can promise you eternal bliss and the afterlife and can threaten you with gnashing of teeth and burning in hell forever. Right? That's easy to do. If I would start a new religion, Becherism, right, of which the main precept is deposits in my account, it's Bank HaPoalim in Givat Shaul, by the way. But if I would start to rule in Isaiah, and if you don't do that, you'll burn, and if you do that, eternal bliss, I am in no danger of contradiction. No one's going to come back and say, what the heck, I died last week, I didn't give him a cent, and I was fine. Right? It's not going to happen, because it's beyond the range of our experience. However, if I have something realistic and significant, and I'm confident about its truth, and I say, if you don't give me the money, you'll all be exiled to Babylon. right? Or a nation will swoop down and do this and this, as you saw in the prophecy lecture. That's significant because that's something that can be tested. That's something that can be falsified or verified. It's significant. It's in this world. So why does the Torah avoid mentioning this? Because it's not that significant. It can't be verified, can't be falsified, not a significant statement. Another answer, which is given by the Sefer HaChinuch, he says the following. Sefer HaChinuch in the introduction, he says the following. He says that we have a principle in the Talmud, which is Lama Likra Svarahu, which means, why do I need a verse? It is logical. Now, if I can work out something from first principles, from logical axioms, I don't need the Torah to tell it to me. I can work it out myself. What do I need the Torah for? I only need the Torah for things I wouldn't necessarily work out from axioms. So now he says the following. Let us assume for the moment that we believe in God, but don't believe in the world to come. Let's assume that. We believe in God. We don't believe in the world to come. He says, is that a logically sustainable belief? Could you accept such a belief? His claim is absolutely not. It's ridiculous. Why, he says? Well, if you believe in God, then God is the perfect being. So he's perfectly efficient. Let's have a look at how efficient God's world is. How efficient is it? Well, let's say what would be the product of what God wants in the world? Righteousness, spirituality, morality, ethics, something along those lines. He said, well, let's have a look back at human history. How much of human history has been involved in the achievement of that perfection? Let's have percentages here. Well, according to the Medrash, right, Adam and Eve were created Friday morning. When did they sin? Friday afternoon. That's 6 hours. Okay, when was that sin corrected? When the Jews got to Mount Sinai, right? 1313 BCE. That's 6 hours. Right, how long did it take for the Jews to fall at Sinai? From the time they got the Torah till they worshipped the golden calf was 40 days. So you got 40 days, 6 hours so far out of 2,500 years. Not very impressive. When was that sin corrected? When King Solomon built the temple. How long did it take for the Jews to fall again? About a day. About a day, yeah, during the festivities for the dedication of the temple. So now we've got 41 days and 6 hours out of about 6,000 years. If you had a factory, out of every 6,000 years, it had 41 days of successful production time. What would you do? No, you wouldn't shut it down. You'd burn it down. Right? But leaving that aside. Right? Get the insurance. Right? Anyway, but again, if you had a factory, I mean, that's not a very efficient production system. And think of it in terms of our own life. How much of our life is spent in moral and physical and ethical perfection, in the pursuit of that? Well, how much of your life is spent, first of all, sleeping? I suppose it varies, depends on how many lectures you go to. But let's say, on the average, it's about a third, I don't know, a third of your life. Goodbye, a third of your life. Right? First 13 years, 12 years, you're not obligated in the commandments anyway. Another 13 years out. Right? Until you're age 20, right, we have a principle that you're not really punished for many, many sins because, I suppose, it's a recognition of the difficulties of adolescence. But again, first 20 years, goodbye, Charlie. So you got out of the next 50 years or so remaining, right, 60 years remaining, a third of that is sleeping. How much of that is brushing your teeth and flossing? Very important stuff, but not spiritual perfection, right? Get rid of that time. You know, changing diapers, very important fulfillment as a Jewish parent. It always inspires me to do it at 2 a.m, right? I just get a real rush out of that, you know, right? But leaving, take that away, right? How much of your life is left to engage in spiritual perfection, for heaven's sakes? Memorial Day weekend, Labor Day weekend, I don't know, Pesach. Well, not that much time. So he says, that's A and B. C, he says, if you believe in God but don't believe in the world to come, where should justice be fulfilled? Right here. That means, a person who is evil, where should he get his punishment? Right here. Person who is righteous, where will he get his reward? Right here. We should see total compensation on every level right here in this world. Do you see that? Not a heck of a lot. Right? You can see it sometimes, but there are plenty of times where you could have a person who's a vicious, sadistic murderer becomes a head of state. So what's his punishment? He's denied a visa to the United States. Big deal. Many people, well, it doesn't matter, okay. Right, but that's his punishment, right? He's denied a visa in the United States, right? So then you've got people who are pious, righteous, wonderful people, suffered terribly. Where was their reward? The answer is we're only seeing a small slice of existence, a tiny, tiny part of the sum total of human existence, because the sum total of human existence also includes the soul. And the soul is spiritual, lives a heck of a lot longer than 80 years, 90 years, 100 years. The soul lives eternally. And hence, what we see of existence is a tiny, tiny, it's like a keyhole of existence. You look through, you don't know what you're seeing. 18 frames a second, right, for a movie. You see one frame, you don't know what's going to happen before, you don't know what's happening afterwards. Many, many examples of that. We don't know, right, how things happen, why things happen, misfortune, etc., etc. We just know that we only see a small frame of existence. And he says, therefore, if you believe in God, and if you are reading the Torah, and the Torah says there's a God, he says it's a logical extension of that is that there is more to existence than what meets the eye. There's more to the world than this life. That is how he answers the question. Nachmanides, in a similar vein, says that also it's a logical olam haba, or the idea of spiritual reward, is very natural. He says the concept that the human being has a relationship with God brings me closer to God. Well, clearly that means I'm going to have a closer relationship. That's what olam haba is all about. He says that's not surprising. What is surprising is whenever there's a link between our actions in this world and our moral actions in this world and reward and punishment in this world. That's very strange. That the Torah does talk about for the Jewish people, there's a link between the morality and the spirituality of the Jews and our peace, security, success in this world. He says, but that is miraculous. When that happens, it's miraculous. Why is it miraculous when there's a linkage between my morality and my success in this world? The answer is quite simple. If there was always a linkage between my morality and my success, would I have free will? No. I would be a rat in a Skinner maze. Right, where these poor rats run around the Skinner maze, they press one lever, they get food pellets. They press the other lever, they get electroconvulsive therapy. Right? And they're running around the stupid mazes, right? Some psychology student, like, you know, watching them. Right? I mean, that's it. That's not what God wants. He doesn't want us to be in a situation, you know, you walk into a store and you want to, you know, you look at your calendar, you say, oh, look at this, 30 shoplifting days till Hanukkah. Right? And, you reach for an object, you get an electric shock. Right? And, you know, every time you try to steal something, you get an electric shock. So you walk out onto the street, very dejected, you see a person, filthy, lying in the gutter, right, reeking of alcohol, right, and an alternative lifestyle. And you then give him a quarter, you give him some money, and as soon as you give him a quarter, a television crew runs out and says, congratulations, you're on the Jay Leno show, you win $1 million, you're the first person today to give charity in New York City, right? Wow, that's cool. So you try to steal something, electric shock. You give charity, you win $1 million. Then what would you be? Would you be human? Of course not. You'd be a laboratory rat, right? A non-human animal research participant. That's what you'd be. So Nachmanides says it is quite natural that there should be a linkage between my connection and godlike behavior here and my connection and compatibility with God there. That's obvious. What's not obvious is that there should be a connection in this world. And that's why the Torah speaks only about the connection in this world. It speaks about that which is not obvious. It doesn't speak about that which is obvious. The last answer, which is my favorite answer, is that of Rabbi Yosef Albo. But in order to understand his answer, we have to get a little bit grammatical. I know it's the end of the seminar and we're going to do some grammar. Okay? What is the opposite of the word this? That, correct. This and that. So now, what is the Hebrew word for this world? Olam hazeh. So what should be the word in Hebrew for that world? Olam hahu. This world is hazeh, that world is ahu. Now, the rabbis are always very accurate in their Hebrew. And yet here, there is not a parallel. It's this world and the world haba that comes, as opposed to this world and that world. Why do they do that? That's question number one. Grammatical question number one. Grammatical question number two. You may have heard of a very famous Mishnah, which says the following. Kol Yisrael, all of Israel, has a portion. Please complete it. In the world to come. Wrong. That's not what it says in the Hebrew. What does it say in the Hebrew? All of Israel has a portion. Le'olam haba. Kol Yisrael yeshem chelek le'olam haba, which means to the world to come. Not in the world to come, but to the world to come. What's the difference? There's a big difference. Right? If you'd say it's that world, if I say I've got a portion in the world to come, what does that imply? It's right there now waiting for me. It's like disconnected. It's another existence. And it's like reward. What I do here, I'll go there and I get to the appropriate level, you know, gate, like all the jokes, you know, et cetera, et cetera. Right? There's a reward and there's a punishment. What I do here, I get rewarded. What I don't do, I get punished, et cetera, et cetera. That is not what it's about. That's a misconception. For example, a child goes to the doctor for an inoculation. And the doctor says, okay, hold still, Johnny, for the injection. The kid, I don't want it. He says, I'll give you a lollipop if you do. Okay, so the kid gets the lollipop, he holds still, and he gets the injection. Now, what is his reward? The lollipop is a reward for obedience. Is that the true benefit, though, of what has just happened? The true benefit that he has received is he is immune, hopefully, to this sickness. Okay? That's the true benefit. The reward, olam haba, is not the lollipop. Olam haba is the inoculation. It is a natural consequence. If you have severed your connection with spirituality, you sever your connection with the world to come. Because when it says olam haba, what it means is this, the world that comes from this world. It is a result of our actions, both good and the opposite, in this world. I have a portion, not in, but towards, meaning that my every action that we do has an impact in the physical world, but we believe it also has an impact in the spiritual world. An example, if I pick up a 10-kilogram object and raise it 1 meter, what have I done? How much work have I done? Well, you know, you could estimate what gravity is 9.8 meters per second squared, weighs 10 kilo, so we're talking about 0.98 kilojoule of work, let's say, right? Not much, right? Doesn't justify an extra dessert, right? Doesn't even justify a spoonful, right? But it's something. But that's on a physical point of view. But what if the 10 kilogram object is a crying child? And I lift the crying child 1 meter in the air. Can I estimate what I've done purely in terms of kilojoules and calories? Of course not. I'm missing the point if I do that. I have given love to a human being who is a recipient now of love and care, who hopefully, because they are a recipient of love, will be a giver of love, will be someone who appreciates this, maybe a more sensitive person. Who knows what can be the effect of that action? From a spiritual, moral point of view, the action has no limits. No limits whatsoever. One minor action can have a tremendous impact beyond anything we can understand in the spiritual world. I'll give you an example. It happened to me. I was in Johannesburg about 3 years ago, South Africa, with a good friend of mine, also a relative, and he was recently NIFTA, recently died. So I had a very busy lecture schedule there, but we decided it was busy. We'd take off an afternoon and go and have a barbecue. So the two of us got into the car to the barbecue, and we went out to a place called Hartebeespoort Dam, which is a couple of hours outside Johannesburg. There's acres and acres and acres of grassland and forest and a dam. It's beautiful. It's absolutely stunning. The middle of nowhere. So we go out there, we choose a place at random, and we say, let's set up the barbecue here. So we got the barbecue on, right? The boerewurst and the steak is on the barbecue, and he sees three hikers in the distance. And he says, hey, look, there's some hikers there. I say, yeah. And he says, let's call them over. I said, what, are you crazy? Total strangers, middle of South Africa, right? He says, yeah. He does this. Okay. That's his action. Very minor action, right? Chemical energy into kinetic energy, increase the potential energy of the hand. And so, not much, right? You know, a little wind energy, who knows, right? Lifts it up. And they wave, and he waves, and they come over to us. As they come closer, one of them says, hey, look at this, two rabbis. And I said, oh, great. You know, we picked up a bunch of anti-Semites. Here we go, right? So they start talking to us. They're Jewish. The three of them are Jewish. They happen to be three friends who happen to be Jewish, and that's about it. None of them have been in synagogue since their bar mitzvah. They had not eaten kosher food in their entire life. And they were not members of a synagogue or a temple, nothing. And we're talking to them. And one of them says, I have one connection to Judaism. I said, yeah, what is it? He says, I often write to a website based in Israel with Ask the Rabbi questions. And I get some answers I like. And I said, really? I said, what's the website? And he said, O-H-R-O-R-G-I-L. And I said, what's your email address? And he told me, and I said, I answered his questions. I answered his questions. The one link he had to Judaism was me. And we are in this car, hours outside Johannesburg, and they're on a hike. And my friend goes like that. You know, 2 years later, I came back to Johannesburg. A fellow walks over to me in shul and says, good Shabbos, Rabbi, remember me? And I said, no. And he says, John? He says, we met at the heart of Beersport Dam. He says, I was so blown away by having met the one connection I have to Judaism in the middle of nowhere. He says, it was clear to me that God is saying, come on. He says, so I did, and here I am. And he's married, and he has children, and who knows the impact. And all it was one action, one mitzvah, an incredible thing. So we say that I've got a portion towards the world to come means the way we judge our life and our actions is not based on the physical outcome. It's based on the spiritual outcome. The world to come is the world that comes as a result of what we do here. It is a reliving of our life on the spiritual plane. So that when he relives the wave will not be just a wave. All the generations and the righteousness and everything else that came from that will be inherent in that wave. The intensity of that experience will be something incomprehensible. Incomprehensible. Right? That's the intensity of the spiritual experience. Right? We will relive with every single aspect of it, good and, God forbid, the opposite. We'll relive that. That will be the world to come. And I think that is why he says it's not mentioned in the Torah. He says, because really the whole Torah is that. It's just that, like in this world, every action has both physical and spiritual, and everything in the physical is a metaphor for the spiritual. The written Torah as well, everything in the physical written Torah is a metaphor for something spiritual. He says, when it talks about rain, do you think it means precipitation? It says you will be rewarded with rain. Of course, on one level it means precipitation. On another level, though, what it means is an outpouring of divine influence, of divine love, of divine benevolence to the human being that refreshes like rain, that causes things to grow like rain, that connects the heaven and the earth like rain does. He says everything can be understood on two levels, just like every action can be looked at on two levels. Ogden Nash, great American poet. Ogden Nash, I cannot remember a verbatim quote, but Ogden Nash writes that he says, if you look at a drop of water and analyze it under the microscope and figure out that there's some salt in it, maybe you'll even figure out that it's a tear. Maybe. He says, but is it a tear of joy or is it a tear of sorrow? Is it a tear of love or anger? Is it a tear of parting or is it a tear of meeting? He says, all those you can't know from the microscope. And the truth of the matter is, actually, there's a book on tears I recently saw a review of that says you can, but anyway. But the point is that the physical examination doesn't get the essence of the tear. The essence of the tear is all the spirituality and the emotion and everything that's behind it. That's what it is. So to speak, I think Ogden Nash, although I don't know if he meant this, is saying there's an Olam Haba aspect to the tear and there's an Olam Haza aspect. The this world aspect of the tear is the salt and the protein and everything else in it. And what's the Olam Haba aspect of the tear? What was all about? The joy, the happiness, whatever it was, that's there. So when we look at life as Jews, we look at life and we say, you know what, just as the Torah can be read on two levels, physical and the spiritual, this world and the world to come, everything we do in life has to also be understood on those two levels. When I do an action, it's not just physical, limited, finite ramifications. It's got eternal, spiritual, infinite ramifications. And that's the way we live, and that's the way we have to understand our life, and every tiny action and every tiny mitzvah has that impact. Let me just conclude with a story. A friend of mine from England was enrolled in a yeshiva, Gateshead Yeshiva. Yeshiva in the north of England, rabbinical school. And he was planning on leaving. He had a month to go, and he was planning on leaving, going into business. And about a month beforehand, he gets called into the dean, who says there's a family in Newcastle upon Tyne, right nearby, who would like a tutor twice a week in Jewish studies. He says, I think you'd be good. The guy says, okay, what the heck? He goes and he teaches his family, and he likes teaching. He finds out that he loves teaching. First teaching experience, and he loved it. And he decided to stay on. And he stayed on for another couple of years, and he is now the most successful campus rabbi in England. He sent thousands of kids to Israel. He's inspired thousands. Unbelievable. All as a result of this family hiring him to teach them. And then he got to thinking, why did this family hire me? What suddenly motivated this family in the middle in Newcastle, totally secular, to start hiring a tutor in Judaism? So he asked the man there, and the guy said, well, I'm a businessman. He says, I was on business in Moscow, pre-Glasnost. And someone asked me to bring religious items to Moscow for the refuseniks. He says, so I said, what the heck? I'm not taking much luggage. I'll take a suitcase full of stuff. He says, I took some sidurim, havdalah stuff, yeah, a few things. He says, I gave it out to different people who had applied for visas, who were getting into Judaism, etc. He says, the last Saturday night I was there, I visited a refusenik. All I had left was a havdalah candle. That's it. He says, I gave it to this guy. The guy broke down crying. I said, what's the big deal? It's only a candle. He said, you don't understand. A rabbi was here 2 years ago and told me that I should take one mitzvah and really try to do that mitzvah 100%. He says, I decided the havdalah, what we did last night, Saturday night at the end of Sabbath, that would be it. That would be my place where I'd make the maximum effort. Last Saturday night, my havdalah candle that he gave me ran out. Okay, you can use any candle. You can use two matches, for heaven's sakes. But he said, but I had an emotional attachment. You come the next Saturday night with a new havdalah candle. I said, this is clearly divine providence. And he said, the businessman from Newcastle, he said, I was so inspired by this person in Russia who in the midst of all the adversity, in the midst of all the opposition, had taken on this mitzvah, I decided that I would start learning about Judaism, and I hired you. So in other words, it was this guy who decided to keep Havdalah with a candle. What was the impact of his action? He inspired this businessman to learn about Judaism. Right? And this businessman hired a guy, and the guy he hired turned out to like teaching, and because he liked teaching, he turned out to be a successful rabbi, and he's inspired thousands of university students in England to search out Judaism. And Natan Sharansky still doesn't know, he still doesn't know what he did with his little havdalah candle. He has no idea. Right? But all of that is one action. So I always think of it, instead of looking at the big picture, which is overwhelming, I try and say every action has a portion of the world to come and a portion of the world of this world. Right? And let's hope that every single one of our actions will be imbued with that type of power and potential, and it really is imbued with that, because we all have a portion towards the world to come in our actions, and through each individual action, we should have an impact on ourselves and on the entire world to bring it to perfection. Thank you very much. Thank you.